Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Specialist in Veterinary Anesthesia and Analgesia, Karen Walsh. Thank you, Karen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema. So today, I think probably we'll be looking at something that a lot of you see in your clinics. And the pug on the right-hand side is probably one of your most common respiratory patients nowadays, or variation of thereon. So we're going to talk about assessment and stabilization, but what we need to realize with a lot of these patients that come in potentially an emergency situation is that we're going to do stabilization and diagnosis at the same time. And potentially our diagnosis is going to stop at a certain point at where we can get that patient to be safe, allow them to be then further stabilized, and then carry on when things are a little less stressful for you and for them. As with any patient, what we want is a good history and a good physical examination. History, really important to find out from the owners, has this been a condition that has been gradually increasing over time? Is it acute? Do they have any other comorbidities that we need to worry about? So physical examination is probably a big part that I'm going to talk about initially, and adding in and intermingling with that is looking at some of our further diagnostics, and I've tried to put them in where they're appropriate so that you can sort of see maybe someone like my mind thinking how I would think about things. And because we do stabilization and diagnosis at the same time, it's actually quite difficult to say, yes, you do this, that, this, and this in this order, because you're probably going to be doing a lot of things all together. So if we think about when we're trying to specifically assess the respiratory system, there are several physical things that we want to look at. We want to look at rate and character of respiration, and this is something that we do without actually potentially even touching the animal. As they walk in, as you're watching them maybe in the waiting room even, we want to look and see about their how much effort they're making. Have they got an inspiratory or an expiratory character of their respiration? And I've got some videos of that. We then obviously want to get on to touch the patient. We want to auscultate them. And part of our sort of hands-off approach is also to look at body position, because the body is an amazing thing. We naturally want to do things that make whatever disease we have better or mitigate its symptoms. So often you'll have very classic body positions for patients to be in who are probably having problems with respiration and breathing. And then if we think about other things we might want to do, we potentially might want to use something like pulse oximetry. And in general, if you try to think at least above 92, if not above 95% on room air, I'll talk a little bit about blood gas analysis, because I think people have more ability to have that on available now. And also then think about oxygen therapy and the response to that, and then radiographical imaging studies. So thinking about breathing pattern and how that might help us with site localization. And as with all of these things, it's not an absolute yes, upper respiratory airway disease will always have an inspiratory effort, but probably 99% of those patients will. So upper airway disease, we look for inspiratory effort, a long and low inspiration. And my first video is a Labrador with laryngeal paralysis. There's a lot of noise, and that can make things quite stressful for the owner. And also when you're auscultating, just be aware that you may have some referred upper respiratory tract noise. And the examples of those are BOAS patients, all our brachycephalics, but also for me, the classical old Labrador, the laryngeal paralysis. Then thinking about our lower airway disease, so it's quite important to try and distinguish between upper and lower, because it's going to be a different pattern of treatment that we're going to adopt. We're looking more at expiratory effort and a slow expiratory phase. There's often not a great deal of noise. You may hear some wheezing, certainly on auscultation, and sometimes when, if they have got particularly bad respiratory disease, a feline asthma that's fairly well advanced. And then the two that are probably less easy to distinguish when we're looking just at pattern and breathing noise are the pulmonary parenchymal diseases. So that often is mainly inspiratory, but it's not always. You will, though, tend to have harsh sounds, plus or minus crackles. And what you're thinking about with those ones is pulmonary edema, pulmonary contusions. And then the last one is pleural space disease. And really what you're looking at is a patient generally that has a shallow inspiration. And if you think about the disease process, if you have got extra fluid or extra tissue in the pleural space, that's going to make sense because you're not able to, or the patient's not able to expand their lungs as well as they should do. And they may also have dull lung sounds because you're not getting that transfer of sound across from the lungs moving in and out or in expanding and contracting. And there we're thinking about our pleural effusions and our pneumothoraxes. So our first video is a Labrador. He is obviously making a lot of noise. And if you look really closely, you can actually see that the greatest amount of noise is associated with his inspiration. And that's what we would describe as inspiratory stertor. So this sort of reverse hacking almost. And that's something that's really classical. You can hear that coming down the corridor. And at the end, my last case, that is certainly what we heard with him. So it's very... once you've heard it, you definitely remember it. The next video is of a cat, and really just have a look at what the effort and where the effort is with this cat's breathing. So ignore the ventilator sound in the back, but what you can see with that cat is if you look, open mouth breathing, obviously, which is not normal in a cat, but quite an effort when it's breathing out and quite a long expiration as well. So that is definitely what I would consider to be expiratory effort. Our third one is a little Cavalier. I suppose, again, probably classic for our pulmonary parenchymal disease. And really, I think you probably could describe that he has got inspiratory and expiratory. There's a little bit more effort when he's breathing in, but also there's sort of like a hum as he's breathing out. The other thing to notice with him is he's not lying down. And also he's got his neck extended, which we'll talk a little bit about in a second. So he's actually giving quite a few signs of him having a respiratory issue. And it's probably secondary to another. It's probably secondary to cardiac disease in a Cavalier King Charles. But we know that he's got a respiratory component to that. And our last one, looking at our types of breathing, which just shows how... really to demonstrate how difficult it is to look at their breathing pattern. The pleural space disease, this is a greyhound, and as you can probably see from the shaved patch on the side of the chest, it's had some form of draining. And really what we can see from that is that dog is panting. So it's not always very easy to distinguish, but what I think is quite interesting or quite good to note is that the chest movement wasn't very good, so it's not like it's making lots of effort to breathe, and a lot of these dogs, he probably wouldn't lie down because he's able to maintain his ventilation quite nicely by sitting up. So just we touched a little bit on body position with the cavalier, but something that is quite classic is, and you'll see this in brachycephalics and other dogs with lower airway disease as well, that they have this neck extension and they potentially also will abduct their elbows. And the aim of this is that the body knows that they want to make as little resistance to inward oxygen flow or air flow as possible. So they're trying to make it's trying to make it a straight line, basically. You'll see a lot of brachycephalics will put their chin on something. Again, I think it's a way of making sure that there's no bends in their respiratory tract. As we saw with the cat, we might have open mouth breathing, and although that's relatively normal in a dog when they're excited, we know that that's an abnormality as soon as we see it in a cat. And the other two things to look at is abdominal movement. You may see an increased abdominal movement with inspiration and ink, so sort of signifying an increase in effort. But also you might have what's called a paradoxical abdominal movement. So that rather than your abdomen moving out as your patient breathes in, it will actually be sucked in. And that can be seen, and it's sometimes the only thing you see in cats, maybe if they've got a pleural effusion, or whether they've had a diaphragmatic rupture, but obviously nobody knew about the trauma. So just looking at this Airedale, you can see he's really extending his neck. He's trying to keep things as straight as possible. And as you can imagine, that probably makes life quite hard for them. They're trying to have a lot of muscular effort to do that. So they have to be expending more energy. Something else that we can potentially see in our patients is cyanosis. There are some caveats, or one caveat with that, they have to have enough hemoglobin to be able to see, for us to be able to appreciate cyanosis. So you need at least 5 grams per deciliter of hemoglobin. So if you've got an anemic patient with respiratory compromise, then you may not see, if they're very anemic, you may not see cyanosis. The other thing that is also good to know is that you will not see cyanosis until you've got 70 to 75% saturation. So if you think our aim in general is to keep our patient saturation above 95%, certainly when we've got them anaesthetized, that's quite a large or quite a big jump from there. So that's why pulse oximetry, certainly in humans, is a vital tool to give you an idea of whether there's an impending respiratory crisis. Unfortunately, our patients, it doesn't always work so well, but certainly if you can use a pulse oximeter, then it helps you sort of have an early warning system. And you can sort of differentiate between central and peripheral cyanosis as well. Because I've talked about pulse oximetry, I thought that was a good point to talk about oxygenation in general. Obviously, as I was just discussing, we can use pulse oximetry to assess oxygenation. We can also use blood gas measurement. Blood gas measurement is still the gold standard. There are cheaper machines now that we can use, and I think it is more readily available than it used to be, even sort of 5, 10 years ago. But what it does is it gives us a reading at one point in time. It's not giving us a reading of as things are happening. That's where pulse oximetry really is good. And if you can, if your patient is able to tolerate it and you can place a probe on the ear or the foot or something, then it actually makes your lives much simpler when you're trying to assess your patient's response to treatment. When you're doing blood gas measurements, then it's always important that you sort of say how much oxygen the patient's on. So in room air, they're going to be on 20% oxygen. So that's sort of the level that we're going to be looking at. If we've got 760 millimeters of mercury of pressure, we're looking at about 152 millimeters of mercury of oxygen that your patient's going to be breathing in. So we're looking at 80 to 110 millimetres per mercury. And that gives us about a 98 to 99% saturation. We would classify hypoxemia or low oxygen level in the blood as less than 80 millimetres mercury, and that's less than really, it's less than 95%. And you can see that there's quite a, if you go to 90% saturation, you're getting about 60 millimetres of mercury. So it's quite a big drop between 95 and 90. And the reason for that is the oxyhemoglobin saturation curve. If we, I'll get my pointer. So if we get our, we see our 90% saturation, it's going to get us sort of, I'm not very good at drawing, we're probably getting about there, so 70 to 80. And then very quickly, if we're getting even to 80% saturation, it goes down very quickly in terms of actual oxygen content because of this, what they call sigmoid curve. So the drop off is relatively quick. Again, another reason why we're using pulse oximetry where we can, but there are limitations. So arterial blood gases can obviously give us an idea of oxygenation, but it will also give us indication of ventilation and acid-base balance, which will potentially be important with our patients in respiratory crisis. There are certain practicalities which is will probably make it much more difficult to use than actually getting the machine. If you do take arterial blood gas samples, you need to have a heparinized syringe, and that can be pre-heparinized or you can heparinize it yourself. I usually use a 1 mL syringe and coat the syringe just with heparin, and really just draw it up in the syringe and put it all back out. You need to do what's called an arterial stab, or you need to place a cannula. Now in humans, they really do, people report that arterial stabs are quite painful. So it's something that you need to be aware of when you're doing it that, that your patient might not like it. Handle the sample anaerobically. Ideally, you would analyze it as soon as possible, remove any bubbles. And for me, the ones that I, the vessels that I would use would be the dorsal metatarsal in the hind foot and or a femoral artery. I prefer the dorsal metatarsal because I can place a pressure bandage on that much more easily than a femoral artery. That usually means that I have to stand there for sort of 10 minutes putting pressure on the femoral artery so that we don't get bleeding. Then if we think about what might make patients have low oxygen, we may have what we call a right to left shunt. So it means that the blood is bypassing the lungs. Also, we might have what's called a ventilation perfusion mismatch. So areas of the lungs may be ventilated but not perfused, or perfused and not ventilated. We see this more in bigger animals, but what where you might see it is in patients that have pneumonias, where their sort of areas of their lungs just aren't being aerated, and then so therefore the blood is not being oxygenated, even though it's going through there. We might have something called a diffusion barrier. So again, that might be like a pulmonary edema where your alveoli, there's fluid in there. It's not allowing the gas to cross that membrane easily. You might also have hypoventilation, so a lack of oxygen delivery into the lungs, and also that oxygen level or the oxygen content of that air may have a low oxygen content. For a lot of our patients, we're not, well, I think most of us aren't at high altitude, so it's not that we're potentially going to have much of a problem with low oxygen levels, sort of the content of the air that's going into our patient. Something that we probably see relatively a lot, so one of our major causes of hypoxemia will be hypoventilation. And a big one for us potentially is going to be airway obstruction. And we will see that again with our BOAS patients. We may see that with foreign bodies. Then probably for me, the next one would be sort of depression of our respiratory centers. And every time we give any sedative drug or anesthetic drug, we potentially are going to depress the respiratory centers. So we have to be very aware, even in a healthy patient, that we may get hypoventilation. But if you give those drugs to a patient that has respiratory disease, then we could push them over the edge into respiratory crisis. The other type of patient that we will see depression of the respiratory center are neurological cases, and that's often brain disease or high cervical disease. So dogs with high neck discs can certainly have difficulties ventilating themselves, and any sort of trauma to the head, again, we're going to be looking for hypoventilation. Probably less common will be neuromuscular diseases, myasthenia gravis. But I think in terms of most first opinion practices, it's going to be of a lesser importance. What we may see more of, again, is what we would call restrictive defects. So those patients that are just not able to expand their lungs, whether there's fluid or air in the pleural space that's stopping effective movement or expansion of the lungs. And then probably a consequence of all of these eventually is going to be respiratory muscle fatigue. The more energy that our patients have to exert to get that oxygen into their blood, the more tired they're going to get, the muscles are going to get tired, and they're going to have less effective ventilation by the end of it. So that can be a real issue for those patients that come in to see you in crisis. They can be at the point where they've been coping, 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 and then they're just not coping anymore. And that's very indicative of respiratory disease. Just to sort of completeness, we can potentially also see hyperventilation. The biggest one is going to be pain, fear, and stress. And again, that can exacerbate what is going on with these patients, because a lot of them will have an increased respiratory rate because they aren't they're not maintaining, or they feel that they need to get more oxygen in. The other one that will increase on its own respiratory rate is a decreased arterial oxygen content, but it's generally very low, like 40 millimeters of mercury. So we'll have a look at Harry. Harry had an RTA, as you can see. He's not looking a very happy chappy at the moment. He's in the incubator, and he's quite obviously got some head trauma. You can see his scabs and things here. His RTA was about 5 hours ago. His heart rate is about 60 beats per minute. His respiratory rate, less than 10 breaths per minute. And unfortunately, his SpO2, his pulse oximetry, wasn't working. I mean, that would be the ideal for him, to be able to use pulse oximetry in him. But we were really concerned. We felt we needed to know what was happening with his ventilation and his oxygenation, to see whether we needed to intervene further. So we did an arterial blood gas on him, and this was him breathing room air. He has a pH of 7.2, PaCO2 of 70. You can see that's very much higher than the normal range. He's also, his pH is lower, so he's acidotic. He's got a low oxygen of 40, quite dangerously low. Bicarbonate's increased. His base excess is thereabouts normal, and his anion gap is normal. So I suppose the next question is, what do we do? And I think one of the things is you have to treat what you see immediately, and then you can think about the intricacies of the arterial blood gas. Probably all of us don't do them often enough to be absolutely amazing, and good at them and to be very confident. So treat what you're wanting you see immediately. So for me, the biggest thing is we need to give him oxygen. We've got a dangerously low oxygen level, and we've also got a very high carbon dioxide level. And what can happen when you have a really high CO2 is it actually is reducing, effectively reducing, the amount of oxygen in your inspired mixture. So it's really important, even if our oxygen had been within sort of normal limit, so above 90, we would have wanted to give oxygen because our carbon dioxide was so high. The next thing I would do is I would check that he hasn't been given any drugs that want to slow his breathing down. So I put question mark antagonize opioids because we have to sort of balance it a bit with him. He's obviously had a major trauma, but if he's had opioids that potentially will decrease his respiratory rate and his ventilation ability, then we may need to antagonize or partially antagonize those. The next thing I would do with this patient is check his blood pressure, because for me, his heart rate was abnormally low. So that's the problem with respiratory patients. With all our patients, they don't usually just have one thing wrong with them. And I'm wondering, is there something else that is affecting his vent? What is affecting his ventilation? Why isn't he breathing adequately? And I know that his heart rate was low, and with if I've got raised intracranial pressure, I may have a high blood pressure and a low heart rate. So that would be sort of the next step that I would do. And then I would think about if I did have high blood pressure, would I want to treat it? But that goes a bit into neuro stuff rather than respiratory. And then I would look at the blood gas again. So looking at the blood gas, as I said before, he definitely had an acidosis. He definitely had a respiratory acidosis because we have a high CO2. We also know he is trying to compensate or has some degree of alkalosis because his bicarbonate was elevated, and we definitely have a low oxygen or hypoxemia. So for this patient, the possible causes for this are a head injury, which I think we can fairly definitely say he has, and we have potentially pulmonary or respiratory pathology, and he's probably got a mix of the two. So that's sort of where I would use blood gases in the way of trying to decide things with some respiratory patients. So thinking a bit more about stabilization, obviously Harry was very immobile. You can see he wasn't doing very much. He was quite obtunded. But a lot of the patients that come in with respiratory disease, and we saw that in the cat that we saw right at the beginning, are not immobile. They're very stressed. They're very worried. You don't want to increase their work, their sort of oxygen requirements, anything. So one of the biggest things that you can do is step away from the patient. Get some way of restraining them and giving oxygen that requires you to handle them as little as possible. So the cat in this picture is actually in an induction box. It's only for a very short period of time. We just really wanted to get oxygen on board, and you probably can see in the background it was going into CT. So we wanted to be able to give oxygen and not be restraining this patient. We want to minimize our oxygen requirements. And also think about things like positioning. Think about trying to keep them in sternal. They're going to get better aeration, better filling of their lungs. They're potentially also going to have better airflow. If we think about what patients will naturally do if they have respiratory compromise. So that also, think about things that don't actually cost very much money, really. Again, about body position, that's not just about when they're conscious. So we have our pug in sternal, our rather rotund pug, being given oxygen, but we're trying to maintain sternal recumbency wherever we can. This can also be if you've got sedated or anaesthetized patients, or if you've got a particularly sick patient. If you've got, a diaphragmatic rupture cat, then trying to minimize what is causing the ventilation issue. So in a diaphragmatic rupture, there is a cat right in the background there. Your viscera, your abdominal viscera, have gone into your thoracic cavity. And what we want to do is use a bit of gravity to try and minimize its effect. So very sort of Heath Robinson, we constructed a sort of tipping platform. I think this was an x-ray plate underneath here, and an x-ray foam wedge, put a bed on it, and put the head at this end and the body down this end, so that we could allow gravity to sort of move those abdominal organs as far away as possible. And in the background, we were very lucky to have tilting tables, but I appreciate not everybody does. So if we think about oxygen therapy, there are some general considerations we need to have. Where possible, certainly for if the patient is going to have oxygen therapy for any length of time, we should be humidifying that oxygen. And you can buy bubble through humidifiers through a lot of the wholesalers now. And the one on the right is a human one. It's supposed to be single use, but I don't think we can honestly say that we did that. We put distilled water in there. The oxygen comes through and is bubbled through that water and comes out this tubing to the patient. And it just means it's trying to mimic what our nose does, what the patient's nose does. So it's trying to humidify that gas, because if we have dry gas going down into the lungs, then we're much more likely to worsen our respiratory problems. We're going to be drying the mucosa. We're going to affect the mucociliary elevator. For a lot of these patients, we need to monitor their temperature. Some of them may be getting hot anyway, but some of our methods of oxygen therapy are potentially going to worsen that. And if we're using any form of closed system, we need to remove carbon dioxide. So the cat that I showed you in the induction box, if we were going to leave them there for any length of time, we would need to have some form of removal of carbon dioxide. So that's either some vent that is going to allow that to be removed, or some form of absorber that you're going to put in there. And where possible, we want to, certainly over time, we want to administer the lowest level of oxygen possible. Giving too much oxygen for too long can actually damage the lungs, so we do have to be aware of that if we're keeping them on oxygen for any length of time. I'm going to quickly go through different types of oxygen therapy and what is easy to use and how much oxygen you can get from those. So this is the easiest and simplest, just what we would call flow-by, and this involves just placing an anesthetic breathing system by the nose. Your handler does have to be a bit aware, because they don't want to be chatting away and then they're oxygenating the eye or the room. Especially the boss won't be very happy that they're wasting the oxygen. It is quite a wasteful way of giving oxygen, and it would probably be what I would do first off when the patient comes in, if they would allow me. You saw the Labrador at the beginning had flow by. It allows us to give about 40% inspired oxygen, so that's double what we would normally be breathing. 2 to 3 liters a minute, you can go higher. It's minimal stress, and that's really important. A lot of our patients don't really relish having a face mask on. And as I said before, it requires a high flow of oxygen, and it does involve a lot of waste, which is not always great. The next would be a face mask, and unfortunately, not all cats, certainly, and dogs are going to be as good about it as as this cat is, with having a mask placed over their face. This cat was fairly poorly. You can get really high levels of oxygen, of inspired oxygen, so 50 to 70%. So that's actually quite significant that you have there. If you've got a really tight-fitting mask, you do have to be aware that you need to get rid of carbon dioxide. If you're using a breathing system, to a certain extent, that will happen with the sort of movement of gas. And if you're using a face mask for any length of time, just check that they're not getting sort of contact abrasions where that mask is sitting. Certainly this cat, if we'd left that mask on there for any length of time, because she was almost like plopping her head into it, she could have had sort of pressure sores. And again, monitor the temperature, especially with the really tight-fitting mask, because they may not be able to get rid of their heat. Something that I really don't use, but is for bigger dogs, could be useful. is an oxygen hood. You can actually buy them, or you can just make them with a Buster collar and some bubble wrap. Again, you need to fairly high oxygen levels to start with, but you can decrease it after a period of time, and you can just put a little bit of an opening to allow carbon dioxide to leave the sort of hood. Probably the really super duper thing is an oxygen cage or an incubator, and really you can only really use this in relatively small patients. But you can get up to 100% oxygen in an oxygen cage, and an incubator probably up to about 75%. You definitely need to be monitoring their temperature and the humidity in these, because they can be fairly, they can get hot really quickly, and the humidity also could affect how the patient is able to ventilate. And again, you need to be able to remove your carbon dioxide. Something that's probably a little bit longer term is to use nasal oxygen. They are the prongs, the nasal prongs are designed for humans, and they penetrate about 1 centimeter into the nose, but they do work well in the larger dogs. You can get different ones, so you can get infant and pediatric and adult. I would probably always go for the pediatric for most of ours, and sometimes I've used the neonatal for sort of really tiny dogs. It's easier to use this in our larger patients rather than masks and things, than it's not easy to put them in an oxygen cage or tent. You can also use nasal catheters, and I would use nasal esophageal feeding tube passed down to the level of the medial canthus, and you can use one nostril or two. I would try with one, and then if I need more, if I'm not doing very well or my patient's not doing very well, I will put feeding tubes down both. And you'll need some local anesthesia, like a drop of proxymetocaine or something into the nose. Again, you can get relatively good oxygen levels with these. This is from a book about respiratory disease, and it's originally from I suppose now quite an old article, where they were looking at oxygen, tracheal oxygen concentration when they used nasal oxygen. And what they did was looked at dogs of 10 kilos and 40 kilos, and you can see that the 10 kilo dogs, you can get actually very high levels of oxygen, almost up to 100%. Your bigger dogs, you had to get quite high flows. And probably the most you would get is 70%, but that's still quite a large increase. So it's definitely a way that you can administer oxygen for a longer period of time, and relatively non-invasively once you put them in. So these were two patients that we used nasal oxygen therapy in. The little spaniel had a pyothorax, and you can see that this one has the human nasal oxygen tubes, and this little spaniel was great. Really didn't, until it started getting well, was not really moving those tubes, but it was perfect confirmation for it as well. And then we have another spaniel, probably another pyothorax, I'm not really quite sure. And this has two nasal feeding tubes. You can see that we've secured it here at the alar fold. And then what I often do is I'll bring it up between their eyes. I've got little tape butterflies on there, and then I usually suture and or glue. I don't like putting them around the side of the face, because I think it interferes with their whiskers. So I think they don't really appreciate that very much. And I would say probably certainly of dogs of this size, you're going to get a maximum of 80% inspired oxygen. And my flow rates that I would use would be 50 to 150 mils per kilo per minute. And what I would usually do is start on the 150 mils per kilo per minute, and I will use my pulse oximetry where I can and try and tailor the oxygen level or the oxygen amount that I'm giving. If you're going much higher than 150 mils per kilo per minute, especially with the nasal prongs, what happens, I think, is that it's going so fast that it sort of bounces off the turbinates and you're not really getting a good amount into that sort of inspired content. So other diagnostics, really sort of X-ray modalities are probably the more important, so X-ray or CT. Ultrasound you can use, I think it needs a lot more technical skill, and what I've seen it used or been involved in using it more is looking at sampling or looking at closer areas more closely for specific things. Bronchoscopy, from my point of view, is not something that I would do in the emergency patient. I think stabilization is incredibly important before we put them under general anesthesia. And a lot of these patients will destabilize once you try and do a bronchoalveolar lavage. So it's not something I would advocate using in an emergency patient. There are other specific treatments that we might want to consider. Feline asthma, probably when I worked in emergency medicine, that was probably one of the things that we saw the most, the dyspneic cat, and then trying to work out whether it was a cardiac or a respiratory problem. With feline asthma, we're obviously going to give oxygen therapy. We're going to use bronchodilators. The bronchodilators will use injectable agents initially, but as we see in this video, we can also, and certainly what I would have in my emergency area, is to have some form of inhaler. Again, it's all very dependent on whether your patient is allowing you to do what you want to do. So this patient has been having a steroid inhaler, but what I would do is start with a bronchodilator and then follow up with a steroid. Parenchymal disease, as we've talked about earlier, edema, your cardiac patient is going to be very high on the list for that. You may have some non-cardiac causes of edema, maybe associated with anaphylaxis, electrocution. Hopefully, you don't see too many electrocutions. Pneumonia probably is something that we'll see relatively commonly, and unfortunately, neoplasia or some other infiltrative disease, potentially like Westie, restrictive lungs. So we're going to do a couple of cases now, and hopefully it sort of brings things together and brings in the imaging a little bit more and a little bit more about thoracocentesis and things. So the first case, I have to say, is actually my own dog, which she did a very good job of making a very good case for me. At the time, she was a 9.5 year old yellow Labrador, and she was fit and well until about 3:30 in the morning. When, probably not in my full ability to think, noticed she had an expiratory effort and apparent abdominal pain. It was sort of like a groaning as she was breathing out. So my first thought was that she had cranial abdominal pain. Took her to the clinic and she responded well to opioid analgesia, but 3 hours later she decompensated, meaning that I had to think a bit more. At least it was a better hour in the morning. So at this point, on her clinical exam, she actually had an inspiratory and expiratory effort. She was becoming cyanotic. So we know there, from that point, we know that her saturation is 70 to 75%. And also it means that therefore we know her oxygen level is about 40 millimeters of mercury. So that's pretty crisis stage. She was starting to lose consciousness. She had an overexpansion of her rib cage as she was starting to breathe. And on auscultation, you couldn't really hear her breath sounds on either side. Her pulses were okay, but maybe a little bit low considering what was happening, 108 beats per minute, and they were decreasing rapidly. So for me, she was our in extremis respiratory patient. So she was at the moment of about to go into cardiopulmonary arrest. So what do you do next? So the first thing, probably because I'm an anaesthetist, the first thing I do is place an IV cannula because I'm thinking I might want to give her an adrenaline or some other crash drug and give her oxygen. So they're the first two things we're going to do. We're going to get some sort of stabilization, and we're going to be doing that together. And for me, because the big pointers in what was happening with her was that she had an overexpansion of her lung and she had no breath sounds. So for me, thoracocentesis was the next thing I was going to do, because my bet was that she had a pneumothorax, a spontaneous pneumothorax, and radiography. But in that sort of emergency situation, for me, thoracocentesis is the, I'm going to do that before I'm going to do radiography, because I need to relieve that decrease in ability for lung expansion. And other things, again, fluid therapy, because for me, she's at impending point of crashing, and also analgesia, because I'm about to stick needles in her, but I would probably be getting on with the thoracocentesis first. So in terms of equipment for thoracocentesis, I will use, my personal preference is a needle for pneumothorax treatment. I don't have great success with cannulas, mainly because I seem to find them blocking up, or I'm sucking on them too hard and they collapse. But other people I've worked with have used cannulas as well, and they feel much safer. So I think it's really what you feel happier with. You can probably tunnel a cannula a little bit better, a three-way tap and some form of syringe. And we're going to go in the sort of between the seventh and ninth rib. And because I was suspecting air, I'm going in the more dorsal, in the more the upper half to a third of the dorsal position. If I was suspecting fluid, then I'd be going more ventral. So it's very much thinking what is the most common. Something that I haven't talked about, but what you could do, is what we call percussion. So looking for dullness if you're sort of tapping on the chest. And sometimes you'll get a line where there's fluid, so you'll hear a different type of sound when you're tapping the chest, or you know, sort of making a noise. So it might give you an indication that there is fluid there. So with Maddie, she had over 1 liter of air removed. It definitely reduced her respiratory effort, and her mucous membrane color improved, but her respiratory rate was still elevated. And this is her, I didn't, as you can imagine, I didn't think to take the video of her when she was in extremis. But this was her after she'd had her initial chest draining. So still, for a fit Labrador, still quite an effort for breathing. And you can see I've drained both sides because I didn't feel I was maybe getting as much as I should do out. But at least she's not stable, but she's not in imminent threat of having a cardiopulmonary arrest at that point. Unfortunately, she didn't stabilize there and just, you know, nothing. What happened then is that she began to deteriorate again. She had increased respiratory rate. She had increased effort again. So we did a second needle drainage. And at that point, I'm thinking, what am I going to do next? So the next thing to do is to do some x-rays. And she has, you can see on here, you can just see this is one of her lungs just waving in the wind, which is obviously not normal. So although I think I drained a reasonable amount, my impression at this point is that she is continuing to leak. And certainly, if you've got a traumatic pneumothorax, often you can drain them and it's not going to get worse. But as we'll see in the end what was wrong with her, it was not going to stop leaking. So we've obviously done radiography. We wanted to get some advanced imaging, and where I was at the time, we didn't have access to a CT, but we need to make her safe to travel because we can't put her in a car for an hour or 90 minutes. and have to drain her on the motorway. I'm not somebody who likes a lot of stress, so definitely I wanted her in a bit of a more stable position. So we decided to place a chest drain. And apologise for my very, I would say, poor chest drain placement, but I did move the chest drain back out a little bit, but it did service p its purpose. And what we used was a small bore chest drain. And I think, especially if you've got fluid that is not very viscous, or if you've got air, then using a small bore chest drain works really well. The ones on the right are from Miele, and these are a Seldinger type chest drain. They really are quite fine. This is the part that goes into the chest. The other one is a Cook, which I'm not sure you can get hold of that anymore. And what we did attach to her chest drain is a Heimlich valve. So this is a one-way valve. She's big enough to be able to push the gas out. So she was able to have that on while she was traveling, allowing her to expel the air out of her chest. The reason for using a small bore is that it's easier to place and it's also less uncomfortable for the patient. And potentially you're going to cause less trauma as well. So I think it's definitely, if you don't think you've got a lot of viscous fluid, then using a small bore chest drain is the way to go. So when we did get her to the place for advanced imaging, these were her CT pictures. They were concerned about something here and here, but even at this point, we couldn't actually work out what was going on. She had evidence of bully in her lungs, and she maybe didn't have the prettiest lungs in the world. They were probably a little bit more infiltrated than potentially we would want. So differentials for a spontaneous pneumothorax, because we couldn't see any tumor was or we couldn't see any sort of outward trauma, was migrating foreign body or ruptured bulla, potentially tumor, but we couldn't actually see anything on the CT, a pneumonia, and what they call subpleural blebs, which are quite similar to bully as well. And this is what we then had to think about. What do we want to do with her once she's stable? We might want to carry on and do some other form of treatment. You could carry on with continuous suction, which particularly if she wasn't stable, that might have been something to do until you did get her to a point of stability, or exploratory thoracotomy to find out where the leak was. And this was her. These were her lungs. If I can grab the pointer, which she doesn't want to come back. I don't know how I've managed that. Oh, there we go. You can see that she's got these little bully here. And this was her lung.
Video in.
She had a partial lung lobectomy, and that was the air that she had quite a big leak. So she had a ruptured bulla. It's quite exciting at 3 o'clock in the morning. So the next case is an English bulldog, and this is really our classic upper respiratory tract patient. 3-year-old English bulldog, history of collapse during exercise. The owner describes him as having excessive panting and upper respiratory tract noise. Unfortunately, as does happen with a lot of these patients, as he was trying to be, as the vet was trying to examine him, he became quite agitated. And the dyspnea continued to progress as the examination proceeded. There was no evidence of trauma or history of foreign body. And unfortunately, it was July and they'd been out in the car for some considerable time. So we'll see what Henry was like when he came down the corridor at work. Oh, we'll see that. Actually, I'll do this bit first. Yes. Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit about upper respiratory disease. And I think the problem with upper respiratory disease is that you get into this vicious cycle. So you have this increased resistance to breathing, whether that's to do with laryngeal paralysis or brachycephalic airway syndrome, and that increases our work of breathing. So when they start to increase their sort of need to go against the resistance, their breathing work increases and their temperature then increases, which in turn increases our oxygen demand. Then if you add into the mix a little bit of stress, this again also increases our oxygen demand, increases our effort, and then it's just like a vicious cycle. So it just keeps getting worse and worse. So this is Henry on arrival. And really, you could hear him coming down the corridor. So we knew that this was not good. We did try to calm things down somewhat, but unfortunately, there are a certain number of these cases where you have to basically anaesthetize them to get control of their airway. Because what you don't want to happen is you don't want them to go into a cardiopulmonary arrest and then you're trying to catch up with yourself. So sometimes when you can just see that they're not responding to any sedation or calming or cooling, then it's at that point that you might actually want to take control of their airway in as controlled a manner as possible, because it's much easier to have everything ready and not to be surprised for it. And this is Henry having pre-oxygenation. I'm not sure how effective this is. And obviously wasn't enough. I mean, he's probably one of the worst bulldogs that I've ever seen. And I think the heat had made things so much worse for him. So we actually did anaesthetize him because we couldn't really examine him. We then continued to be able to do our examination post anaesthesia. And really, to anaesthetize these patients, it's not highly technical. It's having your tubes ready, your laryngoscope, and suction is really important for them because they will have a lot of saliva, thick, gloopy saliva, we would tend to use propofol to allow us to intubate them. But really, whatever anaesthetic agent you are most familiar with is probably the best. A quick induction is also important, because we want to get control of that airway, especially these brachycephalics, because they're much more prone to regurgitation and reflux. We want to get a tube in and an endotracheal tube cuffed so that we have a secure airway. And then what we did, we took his temperature, so he's 39.5 degrees Celsius, which is obviously not great. We did do an airway exam as we were anaesthetizing them. He had, surprise, surprise, overlong soft palate, enlarged tonsils, everted saccules, and then we also did chest x-rays while he was anaesthetized to rule out that he didn't have an underlying pneumonia as well on top of that, because some of these will, because of the reflux and regurgitation that they get, they can get pneumonias. Anaesthesia was just maintained with isoflurane. And thinking about things like if you can't intubate or extubate the patient at the end, we may need to do a tracheostomy, and it may be required for transport. So if you had a patient like this that you're trying to get to a referral clinic, you may have to do that. It's not always the best outcome, because tracheostomies are not without issues. This pug, this was its tracheostomy tube. Even when it was looking, he looked really fine, but the tracheostomy tubes block up so quickly, because what we're doing is sort of bypassing their normal sort of removal system. So through their nose, you're sort of humidifying their gases, and then, you know, they usually would cough it up and swallow whatever secretion is coming up. But with him, that was probably what was keeping him going. We were able to give him oxygen and he was able to breathe until he was, so we could stabilize his upper respiratory tract. So for Henry, what we did, it's not great doing surgery in these dogs while they're so inflamed. So the plan was to cool him down to about 37 degrees Celsius. We gave him low dose sedation with acepromazine so that we had a mild degree of sedation, but also gave us a little bit of vasodilation to help with our cooling. We had, and we chose ATP because we had minimal respiratory effects. There's swings and roundabouts with sedating or giving too much sedation to these. We don't want to make them so sedated that they're not able to walk around. Also, acepromazine can maybe increase the risk, well, lower, makes the esophageal sphincter more prone to opening. And if we hadn't placed an IV cannula already, we would have done that. And then we woke him up. And this is Henry afterwards. And this is nothing more than we cooled him down. Obviously, still a bit of noise, but compared to what was going on beforehand.
After surgery, after my determining TRI, and after collapse.
So he had, that was a different dog, but he's, the idea is the same, that they generally, we're not doing anything to them to, we're not doing anything surgical to them to get them to that state, because what can happen is that they just don't do well after surgery if they are in a bad state. So that's the end of my talk on assessment and stabilization. I hope it's been useful to people. I'm sure there's things that we could have covered, but it's a huge subject. And any questions that anybody wants to ask, I'm more than happy to answer them.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Karen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.